Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Sherry Fink, author of 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. Errol Barron talks about his new book, Roma Osservata, or Rome Observed.
It's my great, great pleasure to be here with Sherry Fink for this One Book, One SIBA event, talking about 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. It's a difficult book to read, it's a painful book to read, but it is also a great tribute to New Orleanians who hope you will never forget what happened here in 2005. Sherry is an award-winning reporter. She's won every award that really matters, I think. She's won the Pulitzer Prize. Her first book was this stunning story of a hospital under stress in Srebrenica called War Hospital. So, Sherry, how did you get into writing about hospitals under stress?
I was actually a medical student, and as I was in school, the war in Bosnia was going on, and I had linked up with some medical students who were in Bosnia during the war, and they were just telling these really incredible stories about what they and their professors and the aid workers had come and done during that war. And I saw links between medical practice in a stressful situation, which kind of hit on some of the same dilemmas and conundrums that we face every day in medicine, but they made them sharper and clearer. And so I went over to the Balkans to look at how medical care was practiced during that war and ended up stumbling on this incredible story about the doctors and nurses who worked under siege for 3 years in a genocide and felt that it had lessons for everyone. And so I took a year off after med school, what I thought was a year off. I'm still on it. And and that became my first book. Wow. And it really took me in a different direction in my life.
So next came Memorial Hospital in Katrina. Everyone from New Orleans knows that story pretty well. And one of the things for New Orleanians, at least, is that Memorial is such an enormous hospital, such a mark on the landscape, that it's rare, I think, that people who live here don't have some personal association with it.
Yes, it goes back to 1926. It was founded as a Baptist hospital, Southern Baptist, and it was known for where women went to have their babies a lot. So a lot of people were born there, and just a beloved place, very well-respected hospital. And yes, it was a physically large structure, so there's a map in the book right, to help people keep track of where events took place. And that was part of the complication of evacuation in a storm, was just getting through 2 city blocks worth of territory, you know, without elevators once the power failed. So a lot of us heard the news after the storm. There were allegations that something horrible had happened in this hospital. Many more bodies were found there than in any comparable sized hospital in New Orleans, and rumors that patients had been euthanized. And after having worked as an aid worker for several years after med school in conflict and disaster zones, and also having written this book about Bosnia, I had never heard of such things even being discussed outside of really the realm of fiction. So I knew that there was something important to look at here and that it was very urgent to look at it before the next disaster.
And it took Sherry so long to write this that in her epilogue, she's actually able to touch on the next disaster in New York, which is like, that's how hard this was to write, I imagine. This is a huge story with lots of people, complications from, I think, medical records, court records, things like that. What was your methodology? How did you set about writing and reconstructing those jam-packed 5 days and after?
It drew on many different sources. So obviously, to write narrative nonfiction, you're not only really trying to get your head around the bones of the story and what the true events were, and that was very challenging here, obviously, but then also because I really felt that to understand what happened at Memorial required visiting or inhabiting the perspectives of a multitude of people, because really the storm, the events were experienced in different ways by different people. And that was really striking in the reporting, was how two people who basically stood side by side could explain their experiences in very different ways, and even their motivations for these actions that occurred at the end, where patients were medicated with drugs and about 20 of them died. And so what was the intention there? What was the situation? And that was described very differently. So obviously it required a great number of interviews of people who had different perspectives on these events in order to create the fullest possible story for anybody who was reading it. And then, because there were disagreements, there were rumors, there were all sorts of different takes on what had happened and what it all meant, it required going further than obviously only interviews. And people's memories fade and change, and that's another challenge of reporting. People remember things differently. So trying to triangulate the information and get to what actually happened was challenging. And so I also relied on everything from, you know, weather reports to pictures and videos that had been taken at the time. Some families opened their medical records of their loved ones to me, toxicology reports on the bodies, experts' reports. I went and spoke with experts in areas of medical ethics and disaster response. And so it's a long answer because it took 6 years, and it felt like all of that was really critical. My goal at every moment was trying to get to the truth. What is the truth? The truth from different perspectives, and what can we make of it? What can we learn from it?
One of the great things that Sherry does in this book is to say what all New Orleanians know, which is that there was a complete failure at every level of every institution. And you just point that out so vividly and so beautifully. And some of that is because these were situations that were new, of course, and you take these fascinating detours through history. Like, she tells you all about triage, for example, and rationing medical care.
Yes, so I think there were sort of two major ethical inflection points in this disaster, just thinking of it as the days went by. And the very first was hurricane hits, levees fail, water's coming. Hospital leaders know that if it gets to a certain level, all power will go out. So who do you save first? And think about the population in a hospital. So there were like 240 patients, 2,000 people total, lots of family members, pets even, that were allowed to shelter there. Babies. Do you save the babies first because of the ethical principle that everybody wants to live as many innings? They call it the fair innings principle, as many innings as possible in life. Or what about the sicker patients who maybe rely on electricity the most? If all power fails, their lives are really in danger. Or do you take the healthier people because you might save more lives that way? Or what about the elders who have the knowledge of society and who have helped others throughout their lives? What about the health professionals themselves? Some of them had chronic illnesses, didn't do very well in the heat, and of course their help would be needed so much after the disaster, as we've seen this need to keep medical professionals in the city. So who do you prioritize first? And this becomes this question of triage, really. And the book, 5 Days at Memorial, it kind of traces back and looks in history of where the concept started. Triage, this idea of trying to distribute resources when you're looking at a population of people who need help and where resources might seem limited at that moment in time, then you switch from your everyday medical care, where you're trying to provide as much care as possible to people who need it and want it, versus in a population where you might be rationing care. And in fact, you would think that there's one way to do this, but there's not. There are a variety of different triage protocols, and it really depends kind of on what your goals are, which gets to values. So do you want to save the most number of lives? Do you want to prioritize fairness or justice? Do you want to be utilitarian and look at years of lives saved, or even quality years of lives saved? And we don't have these discussions very often as a society, but they're more values questions than they are medical questions. And also, what really seems to save lives too is to recall that triage is not just a, here's how you do it, you take these people and not these people, but that we need to think flexibly in a disaster, and that at any moment we could get more resources. It was amazing. In this hospital, some of the doctors went out and they hotwired boats that were sitting in the neighborhood and brought them back to the hospital and started taking out a lot of the civilians who really needed to get out to safety. The dry ground was only about 9 blocks away. They could just get there. So that kind of creative thinking, the way of expanding resources, not just sitting there and waiting for help to come, because as Katrina showed us, we can't rely on that. We need to be able to think flexibly in a disaster, to have our plans, to demand more of the government and private institutions, but also have our personal preparedness as well.
Sherry very bravely went on The Daily Show a few days ago. And it's hard to laugh at this book. It's hard to laugh at anything in it because it just pulls you along into this dark, dark experience. But it's like John Stewart said, you check into the hospital, you want to go, where are your generators? What's the weather going to be like the next few days?
I think it's interesting. You know, when I wrote the book about the Bosnian genocide, the Bosnians, they have wicked black humor. And I think it may be just a way of coping with horrific tragedy that what is amazing about focusing on disasters, I mean, you could think it would be always depressing, but you really see some very positive sides of humanity. And I hope that's really infused in 5 days at Memorial. I mean, these doctors and nurses and family members and employees, cooks, everybody, cleaners at this hospital, they worked so hard in the days, in the heat, scared for their own families. So you see this really positive side of humanity. And sometimes humor is the way that people keep each other's spirits up and keep going. So I too was wondering, how the heck is he going to draw humor from this? But I think you really hit the nail on the head with that.
Yeah. Now, I know this is a hard question to think about, but you write about being in Haiti after the earthquake, and you write about being with a particular patient who was not being given adequate oxygen, and you're watching her fade and come back and fade and come back and go off in an ambulance. And you're a trained physician. I mean, how do you decide when to leap in and take action and when to try and hold back and be objective? And you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there's a spate of doctor reporters these days.
There is, really.
And this came up, but you know, really in Katrina and Haiti, and you saw Sanjay Gupta going and providing medical care as well as reporting. And there are all sorts of really interesting ethical issues around that. And so with Haiti, what I decided to do, I was working on the book, but I wanted to see, how is triage performed? These teams that went to Haiti were the same ones that had worked in the New Orleans airport after Katrina and had been totally overwhelmed. These were federal teams that were sent in. So a lot of the patients from the New Orleans hospitals, rather than fly them all the way to a safe hospital, which would take a helicopter out of commission for a long time, they were deciding at some point to just make small loops right to the New Orleans airport, drop them off as sort of like a triage staging point, have federal medical teams there, and then sort them out, you know, on airplanes, et cetera, out from there. And what happened was that just a ton of patients got brought there, and there were not the helicopters and the airplanes to take them from there. And these federal teams were completely overwhelmed, and their supplies didn't show up, and they were just, you know, some of the people who made these very fateful decisions at Memorial to inject the patients, once they got to that airport and saw how bad the conditions were, they felt, one of them in particular, one doctor said, you know, he had sort of questioned his decision, but once he got to the airport, he thought, well, they wouldn't have been in a better condition if they had gotten here. So in any case, that's a long introduction for the Haiti example. So I wanted to go down, I wanted to look at triage, and I decided that the best way to do it and not have those ethical complications would be to embed with a highly trained, fully supported federal medical team who has all of this experience and work as a reporter with them. And I also waited about a week to go down there because I didn't want to, I felt like it was important for the doctors who are doing clinical work to go down there. And I don't practice clinically anymore. So embedding with one of these teams, with these people who do this work and this is their life's work and they train for it, it felt appropriate that they would have the skills. But then I think it's not even just me as a doctor sitting and watching this woman, this triage choice not to give her oxygen. I think any human being who was sitting next to her and watching her start to suffer would face this question of, do I get involved? Do I advocate for her? And I actually did. Yeah. And I feel, you know, I think it used to be in journalism that there was a very clear line and you just absolutely don't get involved, you observe. But I think that first you're a human being and that is pretty widely accepted in journalism now that if you see a situation that you can do something about, doesn't matter if you're a doctor, you know, whoever you are, that there's some allowance. It's okay to do something about it. So,
Well, you read this book, and first you think, oh, I'm so grateful that Sherry Fink is such a wonderful writer. And then you think, oh, Sherry Fink, go back and be a doctor, and I'll be your patient. I mean, you know, it has that sort of rich humanity to it and rich consideration of the value of human life and the people we are and come across every day in our lives.
Thank you.
Barron is a professor in the Tulane School of Architecture and an award-winning architect who has made his mark on New Orleans. Every time I drive by the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, I smile, knowing I'm looking at the design of his firm, Errol Barron Michael Toups. Errol is also a talented artist and painter, and a new book of his sketches, Roma Osservata, or Rome Observed, has just been published. It's a follow-up to his gorgeous book, New Orleans Observed. Errol, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. Thank you.
For today, we'll call it The Looking Life, I guess.
Okay, all right. Yeah, right. Well, there are a few words in there.
You talk a lot about the idea of observation in the introduction to this book, and looking closely seems to be your way of seeing the world.
Well, it's pretty important for, I mean, I think it's the thing that makes all people who are in the creative world, writers or architects or painters, you know, is paying attention to what the details, the things that happen to you so that your work, whether it's painting, architecture, dance, music, whatever, is based on real experiences. And I'm very, very keen on this point because today in the world of the computer, there's so much that can be done on the computer that couldn't be done by hand in the past. But the role of observation, paying close attention to what the world is like around you, is important if you want your work to have some connection to real experience.
And for architects, drawing is really just a way of writing, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's really under attack today because of the computer. And, you know, the students today, their time is really claimed by the computer because it's fun, you know, and they grow up with a computer. And the computer can do so many wonderful things. But my argument in the role of drawing is that it's a way of critical thinking and visual thinking that makes the work that you do on the computer much more valid and perhaps more vital.
And you really believe that anyone can learn to draw, don't
you? I do. I really do. You know, most everyone can write the, you know, script, and although maybe people don't do that so much either anymore. But yeah, it's a question of paying attention. And Picasso was once asked how he could draw what he did. And he said, well, I'm just drawing what's there. But most people think of drawing as something that is like a creative act, when in fact it may end up being that. But it starts out as being something based on really paying attention to details. And so, I think anybody can learn to do that.
So tell us how you came to spend this time in Rome.
Well,
nice.
Yes, yeah, I know. I know. I've made a lot of people mad. Well, the dean of the architecture school, Ken Schwartz, came to me one day and said, how would you like to teach in Rome? And I said, well, I guess it'd be fun, but there's no way I could do that because I have an office and a partner and so on and so forth. And then I thought, wait a minute, maybe I could, you know. And so I started thinking about it and talked to my partner about it, and we decided there was a way to work it out. And I went back to Ken and said, yeah, I'll do it. And we went and had a wonderful experience and then went back the next year. And really, these stints in Rome were not extremely long. They were really only 8 weeks, 16 weeks for the total, overspread over 2 years. But it's amazing how much happened to me. And it was a life-changing experience, really. I've been to Rome quite a few times before, but never to live. And you almost have to live there to get it.
So tell us about your sketching day. I love the way you describe that. I also love especially that drawing of your bicycle.
Well, I bought a little bicycle in England 20 years ago. I've taken it to Europe, I think, 7 times. It folds up, goes in a small suitcase, will almost go in the overhead of the plane, not quite. And I took it with me, and Rome is such a beautiful city. And so, as everyone says, it's kind of humdrum to say it, but there's an aesthetic jolt about every 5 minutes somewhere. And so I was able, with the little bike, I was able to get out and see a lot of the city. I mean, I covered quite a bit. Rome's not really not very big, you know, unless you get out into the suburbs. the curve, the arc of the river, which in, I have a drawing of that in the book comparing it to the Mississippi, is only about a quarter of the size of the arc of the Mississippi, but very similar in size. So it's not a huge area. And I was with my bicycle able to get around pretty quickly. And I'm an early riser, so I was usually out drawing at 7 in the morning. And people would look at me like, are you nuts, you know? But really, it was the most heavenly experience, because you sit, find a place to sit, a comfortable place to sit, and the world opens up. You hear conversations, you see things, you, and of course the subject in front of you is very interesting. And away I went, and I would usually work until noon and come home and have lunch and maybe a nap, and then I'd go back out around 3 and work until dark, except once I was there later in the year, so I couldn't work until 7 o'clock, but often until 4. I would get out earlier in the, after lunch and work in, you know, 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon. So I was drawing 6-7 hours a day, and over a period of 16 weeks, produced about 300 drawings. And not that I had any goal to do it. I just was having fun, you know. And
Did you arrange them for the sketchbook? When
that's a good question, because it's, you know, I'm not a very organized person. And my wife and I, she had editorial experience and taught English at Newman for nearly 30 years. So she was a huge help. And we kind of started off with a little bit like the New Orleans book, with water. Mm-hmm. And why cities exist where they exist, and how the Tiber flows down from the mountains and gets into the plain around Rome and then is distributed through 100 fountains into the city. And then we kind of went from there to the way the fountains, and then the what I would call the hallmark of Rome, the urban rooms, the outside places. I mean, you know, this is the thing that we don't have in this country. We don't have enclosed spaces. We have lots of space between buildings, but the buildings are so far apart they don't really make intimate urban rooms. So there's a whole section here on urban rooms, and then then we kind of go back and look at the ancient work and so on, the monuments and so on. But it really is more of a love letter to urbanity, I would say. And it was an idea of actually breaking the book into clear sections with a paper, you know, with a title. And I said, you know, it's really not that, because it's not the way, you really don't experience Rome that way. You're jolted from one experience to the other. And the book is kind of that way. You don't really know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. In the book, there is a kind of, believe it or not, there is a kind of order to it. But I'm not telling.
And you see also some similarities between Rome and New Orleans,
absolutely,
of course.
Absolutely. I went to the Italian-American Cultural Center dinner last night and made a little presentation of the book. And a woman there said to me, when she's from Rome, she said, I just, when I came here, I felt so at home. And I said, well, that's the way I felt. And I have the essay that I wrote in the book is called Roma Nola. And I was just utterly struck by the similarities, not physical similarities so much, but the spirit. And also the density and the love of life, I think, is a huge part of it. Interested in food, you know, getting together, doing things. There's a wonderful similarity. It's, I guess, a sort of Mediterranean culture maybe, but in some ways it seems deeper than that to me. I really was touched and moved by the similarity in spite of the huge differences in size and age of the two cities.
And that deep Catholic sensibility.
And that too, yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
So what's your next book project? Have you started thinking about
it? Well, I have, yes.
One?
I'm working on a book on the Tulane Newcomb campus. And actually, there are two books. There's one called The Architecture of Drawing, which I've been working on now for 2 years. And that's really a general book for architecture people about the importance of the role of drawing in design and creative thinking. But the immediate project is a book I'm doing on the campus. I just love to draw so much that I'm drawing every building on the campus. How I'm going to organize this, I have no idea. But the Tulane campus, in spite of what you might immediately think by looking at it, its antecedents go back to ancient Greece and the Renaissance and the Baroque era. And you don't see all this stuff is kind of under the surface, but it's there. And I teach a course called Introduction to Architecture for Non-Majors, and I'd kind of talk about all that stuff. So I'm hoping to use some of my thoughts from that course in this book through the medium of drawings.
Oh, fun, fun. Well, we've been talking with Errol Barron, whose new book is Roma Osservata, or Rome Observed. You can meet him Saturday, November 23rd at 1 o'clock at Garden District Bookshop. Thanks, Errol.
Thanks, Susan. I've enjoyed it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Terry Tarnoff signs The Chronicle of Stolen Dreams, Tuesday, November 19th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop.
Ed and Susan Poole, authors of the reference book, Hollywood on the Bayou, will discuss the film history of Louisiana at 7, Tuesday, November 19th, at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Nick DeDominick and Michael Todd Edgerton will read their poetry Wednesday, November 20th at 8, at the UNO Campus Art Gallery on Harwood Drive, followed by a book signing and reception. The Jewish Community Center Book Fair this week features today's guest, Sherry Fink, discussing and signing her best-selling book, 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. That's Wednesday, November 20th at 7 p.m. For details, contact the JCC at 504-897-0143. Rebecca Solnit and Rebecca Snedeker discuss and sign Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas, Thursday, November 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. They also appear Friday, November 22nd at 5:30 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Room 220 presents a happy hour salon to celebrate the publication of Unfathomable City. That's Saturday, November 23rd from 4 to 7 at the Always Lounge, 2240 St. Claude Avenue. Todd Michael St. Pierre signs a Southern Po' Boy cookbook Saturday, November 23rd at 10:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Diane de las Casas signs The House That Santa Built Saturday, November 23rd at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Errol Barron, signs Roma Osservata, or Rome Observed, Saturday, November 23rd at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. Sunday, November 24th is the Po' Boy Festival on Oak Street. These authors will be signing at Blue Cypress Books. From 11 to 12, Cornell Landry signing Goodnight Nola and his newest book, Tour Old Baby. From 11 to 12 also, Ray Cannata, senior pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church, signing The Apostles' Creed Rooted. And from noon to 1, I'll be signing The Book Lover's Guide to New Orleans. And from 2 to 3, of course, Todd Michael St. Pierre signs his new book, The Southern Po' Boy Cookbook. Hope to see you there. Jacinto Lucas Pierce and Dean Thomas Ellis sign The True Actor, Monday, November 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Snowden Wright discusses and signs his novel, Play Pretty Blues, Tuesday, November 26th at Octavia Books. The Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival is presenting a new event, a French Quarter scavenger hunt with books and booze and coffee too, Friday, November 22nd from 5 to 10. Check in at the Beauregard Kai's House, 1113 Charters, and meet your team or bring your own team or book club. The scavenger hunt takes place at independent bookstores throughout the quarter. Local authors will be stationed at various stores to help you with your quest and answer your questions from 6 to 8:30. Then participants wind up back at the Beauregard Kai's House for prizes and an after party. For ticket info, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. And coming up soon, the schedule is posted for Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, which takes place December 4th through 8th at the Hotel Monteleone. Among the speakers this year are best-selling author Reza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life of Jesus of Nazareth, Lee Froelich, executive editor of Playboy magazine, Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Fennelly, authors of The Tilted World, Walker Percy biographer Patrick Samway, and novelist Ron Rash, author of Serena. For the complete schedule of events, check out wordsandmusic.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading. ¶¶